Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Today in the studio, we've got a very special guest. Reem, we've spoken on a number of occasions about your work, both broadly in financial services, in strategy, and now we want to talk about gender and its spillover effects, its extended impact throughout corporations, industries, and the national economy. So it's a really exciting conversation. I know our audiences would find a lot of value in this and find out more about your work and the research you've conducted. So thank you for making time to be in our virtual studio. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
No, thank you so much for providing me the opportunity. I'm very excited to chat to you in the podcast. So as you mentioned, yes, my name is Reem. I lead strategy at a top Pan-African bank called RMB, which is the corporate and investment banking leg of a wider financial services group called FirstRand. And I'm based in the Namibian subsidiary. And prior to joining banking and joining strategy, I actually worked in academia, research, and national strategy. So I started my career in various universities and top universities in Egypt. And then I did a short stint with the UNDP here in Namibia. And, you know, I share my career journey and people look at my career journey and wonder, you know, how did you navigate between like all of these three different sectors? But it's because I had a vision for myself, and I'm lucky enough to have articulated somewhat of a purpose for myself that I really want to make a positive impact wherever I go. And the positive impact can be at a human and individual level, just helping people think differently, think broadly, think a bit more sustainable, but also a positive impact on economies as well and economic development. And I mean, we're all solving for the same problems. So I really believe in the power of partnerships and the power of synergies. So that's why I first started in academia and research, because I felt, you know, I could have a positive impact on my students, that I could shape the way they think about life and the way they think about their contribution to society. And then I was seeking a bit of something more challenging. So that's why I said, you know, let me go into an international organization, because that's where they solve the real problems. And it was so extremely eye-opening for me to see, you know, the type of work they do in terms of development, in terms of economic development, in terms of policy and technical advice. So that was a great exposure for me. But then I said, you know what, let me try the real economy. So let me get into banking, because banking is where everything happens, especially investment or corporate investment banking, because they have a bird's eye view into the entire economy. They partner with sectors, they partner with clients, they ensure the financial stability of an economy. But more than that, they help clients in their journeys as well, in their own corporate journeys. And that's where I really found my feet in investment banking, and especially strategy, because strategy speaks to my purpose. It speaks to how can I impact people? How can I influence them? And it really energizes me when, you know, when I help people think, when I help them capitalize on opportunities, when we create that ripple effect of impact and I create that aha moment. But strategy and policy and research, they're all, you know, they all solve for the same thing. You know, they're all different facets or different sides of a cube, basically. So yeah, so being this bridge, I've successfully coupled strategy with other disciplines as well. But I didn't lose sight of my passion for research and my passion for knowledge creation. And that's why I pursued a PhD in development finance. And how I got into it was quite interesting, because my entire academic career was business and finance. And then I came to a point where I was like, okay, I'm actually not really passionate about finance, but I'm passionate about the role that finance plays in development. So that's where I then specialized, or my research is focused on FDI and gender, or foreign direct investment and gender. So I really believe in the notion of versatility to remain relevant. And throughout this entire career journey, obviously, gender has been so close to my heart. And it's based on just my personal profile, the fact, you know, I'm a young female. I was privileged enough to get unique experiences and unique exposures. I'm quite in an influential professional sphere right now. But that comes with its own challenges. I'm also quite ambiguous, you know. I'm Namibian, but I'm Egyptian by descent, so I don't conform to people's certain boundaries as well. So yeah, that's a bit about myself.
That's fantastic. So such a rich landscape and set of experiences. I'm sure we're going to delve into these as we start to unpack gender and the multitude of impacts that it can have both at an organizational and a national level. So let's kind of dive in. Let's talk a bit about gender. You know, I must say this is something that over the last few years I've grown closer to, particularly as I saw my own daughter getting into the workplace. And even today, as we sit well into the 21st century, many of the challenges that, you know, the previous generation and even the one before that have been really challenged with is still here today. The World Economic Forum still, you know, forecasting or estimating that it will take over 200 years to reach gender equality. It's an horrendous number. And kind of with that in mind, you know, when we think about gender and its role in the workplace, I mean, I have to ask the question, how did we even get here? How did we get to this current state that this seems, you know, the notion of gender equality, as much as we strive for it, seems so far away?
Yeah. You know, I was reflecting the other day about why are we so focused on producing so much research about the value of gender or about the value of women in an economy. As much as I'm passionate about research, I think it almost needs to be a given because we're almost convincing people that this is something that needs to happen. It's a nice to have. But I think the narratives must change. But with that said, you know, there's been a lot of great strides in terms of the inclusion of women in the workplace. But like everything else, you know, there's always room for improvement. And these strides, you know, the focus has been predominantly on providing women access to labor opportunities. And like I mentioned, various research has shown that providing women access to the labor force has positive impacts on GDP at national or macro levels. But even at micro levels, if we look at firms, the participation of women in workforces has positive impacts on firm performance and profitability. So all of these data points and all of these findings have contributed to a massive awakening or massive consciousness by both private and public sector leaders who now think like, oh, there's actually value in including women in the economy. And something so basic, right? But something so insane at the same time. And if we look at micro level or firm level, there's been concentrated efforts and intentional efforts to develop females' labor, their skills and their knowledge so that they climb up the ranks. And even the research shows that especially multinationals have been at the forefront of this. So females add various dynamics to management and executive teams. You know, now we speak about future leaders being a bit more empathetic, and females have that character trait. They're a lot more empathetic and they're a lot stronger when it comes to their EQ skills as well, which helps then in strategic decision making in boardrooms. And there's also been a bit of effort and some effort to support female entrepreneurs in sort of accessing supply chains. But at the macro level, policies are now increasingly being tilted towards driving gender equality, for example, providing access to education, access to services, access to assets as well. But even in promoting investment, now certain policies, but it's always been the case also since the early 90s, that now policies stipulate the inclusion of females in labor, especially when it comes to investment opportunities. Mm. But the point is that all of this just speaks to labor participation. And labor participation is just the first layer of the onion when it comes to women in the workplace or when it comes to really achieving gender equality.
I mean, that's such a great point. I mean, let's talk about, you know, what happens once we begin to achieve participation. That does not lead directly to equality, right? And I'm very conscious that while we speak about gender here, women are, in fact, you know, the largest minority in a whole set of minorities that very often suffer under the same challenges. So if I had to ask you, you know, what are those spillovers? What happens once there is participation in the economy? We haven't gotten there, have we?
It's a yes or no question. So when you touch on a very important point, which is spillovers, right? And spillovers is just basically the academic world for a multiplier effect. So theoretically, why countries really want to attract foreign direct investment, which comes at the form of multinationals establishing shop in a local environment, It's because these multinationals, they come with new knowledge, new technology that can then be transmitted to the local economy through various channels. So that's basically what we mean when we say spillovers. And that's basically the epitome of my research that was published in the Thunderbird Business Review. I look at what are the channels of spillovers from FDI into the local economy. And one of the channels that I look at is female labor. And that's why in the research paper, we call it gender spillovers. Because another school of thought tells you that, okay, we know that FDI enhances gender outcomes. We know that female labor participation has positive outcomes. We know that women actually have access to different types of information because compared to men, because they need to split their time between professional and personal needs. They don't have access to the same networks. But at the same time, multinationals are actually found to empower females a lot more. So when you combine these two strands of literature, then you ask, okay, how can we use female labor to transmit this knowledge, the superior and advanced knowledge from multinationals to the local economy? And that's what my research found. We found that when you benchmark this gender spillover against the conventional or traditional measures, we find that it's almost equally as strong a channel to contribute to economic development. So to your question, what happens afterwards? What's happened? Great, now we got females in the workforce. What happens now? First, you need to develop that female. You need to provide them and equip them with the knowledge and the skills that they can use to thrive in their environment. And it needs to be sustainable, right? So manufacturing was always said to be to employ higher shares of female labor because they are under so much pressure to keep their unit costs down. And unfortunately, and I hate saying this, female labor is perceived as a low-wage source of labor. But what happens now when these manufacturing firms mature and they bring in technology? What happens? They basically replace this female labor with the new technology. So yes. Essentially, we didn't do anything. We became the whole idea became redundant. So what needs to happen now is that you need to upskill these females. You need to equip them with more advanced managerial, and you need to transition them into what we now call the knowledge economy. But more importantly is that we need to remove unconscious biases. So it's great that we tick the targets of females in the boardrooms, but the real value is when women are heard, when they're given the opportunity to talk, when they're not undermined, when people do not project their own biases on them. I think that's when full and real gender equality happens.
You know, as you were speaking, I started thinking about how our own biases shape what we measure and ultimately what we incentivize for and what we achieve. And I remember in our work in this field, I was fascinating to see how a lot of the linkages between diversity and inclusion broadly and gender participation more specifically leads to a whole host of early indicators of higher levels of performance and particularly of innovation. You know, we speak about the role of, or the impact rather, of a gender diversity on team cohesiveness, on developing new options, on bringing in different perspectives, on evaluating making management decisions differently. And those start to then cascade through the organization. But if we don't measure for these things, if we don't recognize that the way in which we in fact measure organizational performance does not change, then we're likely to disincentivize and not see the impact. So I'm just curious in terms of your research as to, you know, what role does measurement play here?
So it's a very important question. And I mean, you can't manage, but you can't measure. And I think for me, it's twofold, right? So there's a national responsibility to measure the efforts that they are doing in terms to achieve gender equality. But then there's also a micro lens, which is now how firms do it. And really the guidance is to be very articulate and clear in terms of what is it that we're seeking, right? In terms of innovation, is it new products? Is it increased market share? And then you sort of work your way backward and then you start looking, okay, what I just mentioned are more lagging indicators, but what are the leading indicators? And something like gender, it's not, you know, why people struggle with it is because it's a bit intangible. But we have to be comfortable with the fact that some of the measures is just pure qualitative change in behavior, right? So, you know, how is the team dynamic changing when we add a depth of diversity? I mean, we often speak of pizza teams, right? We put pizza teams together to solve for business challenges. So how are the dynamics and the behaviors of this pizza team changing once you add layers of diversity, once you add males and females from different backgrounds, different ages, different cognitive abilities, and you track that behavioral change, and then you start measuring it against the outcome that you're seeking, whether it's product development, increased market share, or whatever it is that you're seeking?
No, 100%. It's really so interesting when you speak about you got to work your way from the back to the front, right? You got to be clear about the outcomes that you're trying to achieve, and then you start to discover not just the lagging indicators but the leading indicators, and you start to see where those linkages actually occur. So this is such a fascinating discussion, and I'm curious to know, what linkages have you found between gender diversity, the higher participation rates of women in the workplace, their advancement, and leadership, and to ultimately sustainability of organizations?
Yeah, no, it's a very important question. So obviously, as part of managing business strategy, we can't lose sight of behavioral dynamics. So you can have the best technical strategy ever, the cleverest strategy ever, but it really comes down to people's behaviors and beliefs and values which drive the implementation of strategy. So in strategy, a lot of the work that I do is also helping leadership dynamics in terms of enhancing mindset, changing mindsets as well, enhancing their EQ capabilities and also their SQ capabilities as well. And what we find is that because of the dynamics of diversity and because of the team dynamics in terms of different genders, different backgrounds, different cognitive abilities, you start seeing the leaders in the group pulling the other members in the group towards changing that mindset in really driving strategy. So as you mentioned, I mean, females come with a whole list of different personality and characteristic traits in boardrooms. And you start seeing that these traits, they change group dynamics. They change the way we think. And in that, it changed the boardroom behavior so that we don't suffer from groupthink. We don't suffer from herd behavior. And we really enhance our behavioral skills to drive the technical strategy.
Now, when you describe that, I often start thinking about, you know, the extended enterprise. I start to think about partnerships and broader ecosystems and how this spills over beyond the organizational boundaries. And therefore, this conversation is important not just for leaders within organizations, male and female, but also to regulators, also to figures of who set national policy and who, in effect, give guidance or direction to the kind of outcomes we want to see in the society. So talk to us a little bit about what kind of spillovers have you seen at a national level? What happens given enough time in the right direction and encouragement? What could be achieved?
It all comes down to policy. And I came across a statement that really resonates with me today, which says that policy is an art and not a science, which for me was mind-blowing, because we all think of policy as a science. But when I thought about it as in terms of an art, you could consider it as a piece of clay that you're sort of molding to get the most beautiful statue or the most beautiful outcome that you need. And why you need to think about it as an art is because policies, they need to make sense for the dynamics of the local context. And we need to spend more time in terms of understanding how policies affect and are affected by the social fabrics in a society, how they're affected by the norms in a society, how they're affected by the collective human psychology in a society. So, for example, women have been excluded from the formal economy for the longest. And these come down to culture and societal factors. I mean, not all families wanted their female or their daughters to have a tertiary education, which contributed to low educational attainment, which contributed to exclusion from the formal economy. So how do you use now policy to shape new structure or this new statue that you want to achieve? And as I mentioned earlier, so if I take investment promotion policies as an example, they include clauses that say new investments coming to the country need to or are encouraged to employ females. Okay, great. But in societies where educational attainment is low, it doesn't become practical. So the thinking now is, how do national institutions or how do public sector institutions create an integrated approach that looks at gender equality from different dimensions, looking at it from investment opportunities, from educational opportunities, even from health opportunities, looking at it from access to services and access to assets as well. And to my earlier point, it also looks at beyond just mere labor participations, right? So these policies need to be molded in a way that allows different genders and women to benefit from new knowledge coming, to benefit from new technology coming. So it's really honing in on that multiplier effect with a gender lens, and must be intentional and not consequential. So not like, oh, great, this came out. No, we have to be intentional about some of these outcomes. But more importantly as well, we need to create an enabling environment for women to thrive. So we often speak about ease of doing business. Well, let's talk about ease of women doing business, right? Catalyst programs for women entrepreneurs to help them access the resources that they require. We've seen how mentoring and coaching programs are found to be very effective for women entrepreneurs. Something like labor laws, they need to support both women and men to balance their personal and professional needs. And, you know, women are cited as more likely to take career breaks than men. So how can we help them re-enter the workforce? And this isn't only a national priority. I mean, I saw an organization recently on LinkedIn that was sharing something called what they called the Restorationship Program. It helps people that took career gaps. It helps them enter the career or the workforce again. So yes, the national institutions and governments, they can create enabling environments through policies or through different programs. But there's also things that private sector can also do.
So Reem, let's talk a bit more about the private sector here. And I'm thinking of this in the context of not of CSI, not of, you know, funneling funds at the margin, which very often just perpetuates current outcomes, but rather to looking at it at organizations, whether multinationals that you referred to earlier, or even local institutions that are challenging their own paradigm, that are seeing themselves as a vehicle to help solve societal problems, that see the unintended consequences when they withdraw from these challenges and just revert to essentially shareholder capitalism. So when you think about the role that corporates can play here, what would you say is most important for their top leaders to hear, to understand, and to be able to respond to?
Yeah. So, I mean, we see private sector organizations now taking on the agenda of ESG more and more seriously. And a lot of them have gender commitments or targets under the S of ESG. And the most common is obviously, you know, women representation in different levels of the organization, which is absolutely fantastic. But like you rightfully said, like what I've noticed is that the gender agenda gets parked with human capital or with the diversity and inclusion teams or with the CSI teams. And that's where the narrative needs to change. It needs to shift and come closer to the core business of firms. So now we have a lot of information and a lot of data at our hands that prove the value of women to organizations. So the question that executives need to ask themselves now is, what are the strategies and what are the tactics that we need to employ to make the optimal use of these dynamics to the best outcome of the organizations? So for example, in another paper that is in production of being published, which now looks at the impact of this gender spillover on productivity, we find that there's a positive effect, but it's dependent on the seniority of the managers. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because senior managers, they have exposure, they have experience, they know how to deal with teams, they know how to deal with diversity, they know how to address affirmative action policies. So they have that experience, and they are the best agents and the best sponsors to drive diversity. And I often say that leadership styles have transitioned. So rather than being in a factory setting and you need to assemble the teams in a certain way to produce the most number of cars, for example, now leadership styles need to still assemble teams, but according to personality traits, according to thinking behaviors, according to diversity, for the best outcomes of the business. So yes, I mean, even though the gender conversation might be a bit more tilted towards talent in the business to drive the best outcomes, I also want to encourage businesses to apply the gender lens to other operations in the business or other ESG factors. So for example, many would have targets that we need to procure locally. Great. What percentage of that procurement is from female businesses? Many would say we need to extend our services to whichever communities. Great. What percentage of those services are to females? We also need to help females, you know, overcome certain structural barriers. I mean, it's often cited that entrepreneurs, they don't have access to debt, and that's all. They don't have access to funding, and that's the main obstacles. It's even worse for females because females, they don't have the collateral, for example, that's required to meet certain funding requirements. So how do we help females in overcoming some of those barriers? Do we provide them other solutions? I mean, there was one paper that I read that said females are actually going to fintech solutions because guess what? They don't ask them for all of these requirements and it's easier for them.
Exactly. It's actually quite interesting. I was listening last night to a presentation by a South African venture capital fund that has done remarkably well pitching South and Southern African fintechs to European investors. It was so interesting to hear of the kind of diversity of ideas, the kind of challenges that they were trying to solve for, and the richness of it that you could immediately look at and say, this applies in so many territories. This goes well beyond just the confines of one industry, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, simplifying point of sale transactions or something else. It was so interesting to just see how young entrepreneurs and women entrepreneurs in particular can participate in this. And the funding question is, while it's always there, it is not the only question that's being asked. It's not the only hurdle. And that kind of leads me to one more question, and that is the role of entrepreneurs, whether social entrepreneurs, technology entrepreneurs, people who are innovating management systems and trying new business models. What role do you see them playing in advancing gender equality, not just in the workplace, but I guess in the national economy?
Yeah, the lovely thing about entrepreneurs is that they're so versatile and they're so agile and they're not bound by, you know, capitalist constraints, if I can call it that way. And what I've seen increasingly happen is that startup tech companies, their business models is really, they're based on addressing social issues in the economies that they operate in. So in advancing the gender agenda, I mean, we always lose sight of the fact that in some countries, females make up around 50% of the of a population. And in most economies, that's market share. So for me, really, it's how can these startups capitalize on their nimbleness to tap into that underserved bottom of the pyramid market. But in doing that, what I really like to encourage these entrepreneurs to do is to really invest in research and development, to invest in experimenting. I don't like to use the word failure, but I'm going to say that, you know, there's no growth without hiccups. There's no growth without obstacles, but it's about being humble and not being despondent. Like, it's all part of the process. So if something is not working and or the market isn't fully absorbing it, then you get up and you move quickly and you evolve. So always having that growth mindset. And to keep that culture of innovation so that, you know, we don't become a dinosaur in the industry. And it's also important is to stay alert to what's happening in the environment, to open and be open to the fact that your strategies and your tactics, they will change. They're about to change because our cycles are so volatile, our environments are so dynamic, and it's fine. And with that said, to also keep an eye on competitors, but without adopting a Me Too approach. So don't lose sleep because of your competitors, but just be cognizant of what they're doing. And I'm going to emphasize this again, but stay grounded in your nimbleness. That's really an advantage that, you know, small startups, they shouldn't lose, because that means they're able to address market needs faster they're able to shift and change according to the dynamics of the populations. But what it also means is that they are able to attract top talent, especially the young talent, because what they're seeking is that, or what they're being attracted to, is fast-paced, high-impact organizations. And they're always hungry to make a difference. So for me, it's tap into a market that is underserved, which unfortunately, I have to say this, but unfortunately, it is a large portion of it is female, is the female market, and then continue innovating, continue experimenting, and continue capitalize on your nimbleness.
That's great. I'm definitely going to quote you on that one. It's such a lovely way of saying this. Stay grounded in your nimbleness. What a great way to end our conversation. Thank you, Reem. This is a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate the time you made for it and giving us a glimpse into the many insights that you researched. I'm hearing not just past, but clear present, and maybe a little bit of that niggle of future research that you'll partake in. Thank you for sharing that with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.